It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a local group just celebrated a national award for innovative work healing abusive men and trying to break the cycle of violence. We'll talk to the founder of the Alma Center about her work.
First, as we head into a holiday weekend and the busiest travel time of the year, national security risks are topping headlines. It's time for a weekly look at the latest in national politics with 538 senior political writer and analyst Harry Enten.
President Obama addressed the nation this morning talking about the Islamic State group. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Given the shocking images, I know that Americans have been asking each other whether it's safe here, whether it's safe to fly or gather. I know that families have discussed their fears about the threat of terrorism around the dinner table, many for the first time since September 11th. And it's understandable that people worry something similar could happen here. Watching the events in Paris made the threat feel closer to home. So as we go into Thanksgiving weekend, I want the American people to know is that we are taking every possible step to keep our homeland safe.
Harry Enten is with us now to tell us the latest about how the political climate has changed since the Paris attacks. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's start with the president's response to the Islamic State. So far, we heard some of those remarks from earlier today. What was the significance and the timing of this briefing?
I think just that people are very fearful. You know, if you look at the polling data, you see that terrorism is starting to top the list of the most important issues. You see that Americans are more fearful of a terrorist attack than they have been in a very, very long time. So it's the president's responsibility or job, or at least he feels so, that he should go out and basically comfort the American people and say, look, we don't have any intelligence that's saying that a specific attack is on its way, but you should be on the lookout, and we're doing everything to the best that we can to keep you guys safe, and you should go out with the comfort of knowing that we're doing so. So, I mean, this is what a president's supposed to do. It's his job, and he did so. But Americans are still on edge, and I don't think that the president's statement's going to take them off of edge, but still he has to go out and try his best to comfort them.
Right, you just used the word comfort three times. It's a tall order for even a president to do. So what form do you think the American people want that comfort to take to feel safe?
Sure. I mean, you know, there's obviously some people want us to go in and deal with ISIL or ISIS with troops on the ground. Most of the polling indicates that that's not what Americans want to happen. We're going to get into the refugees and how we're going to deal with Syrian refugees. The American people are very split on exactly what they want to happen. They just know that they are fearful of a terrorist attack, and the president's job in this, you know, at this point, he is basically the commander-in-chief, and he wants to be able to say, look, we're doing everything that we can. But beyond that, you know, I think the president said it best. You have to be on the lookout. People have to keep their eyes open. Small things can get in. So everybody in America has to do their job to try and prevent what could be a terrorist attack in the future.
And in the meantime, the Paris attacks have shaken up the priorities in the presidential race. What have you seen there?
Yeah, so, you know, if you just look at the polling, and it's not just one poll now. When we spoke last week, it was, you know, the first poll came out that said that terrorism had jumped the charts to be the number one issue in the Republican race. Now we have a few more polls that are showing that. So national security, who can best handle a terrorist attack, who can best keep us safe, is now starting to top the GOP list. And as that has happened, we have seen some interesting things occur, not the least of which is Ben Carson, who really, when he talks about foreign policy, most experts would say he doesn't really have a clear, good handle on it, has started to fall back in a number of the polls.
And with Ben Carson falling back, who's surging?
So we're really seeing Ted Cruz right now, at least in Iowa. There was a poll out yesterday, the Quinnipiac poll, that showed him now second place to Donald Trump in the state of Iowa. I think it was 25% to 23%, a very, very close race. And Ted Cruz is somebody who is a senator, who is a very smart guy, who's very hawkish on foreign policy. So we've seen a real turn, not just in who's in first, second, and third, but just in terms of the tone of the race, the tenor, and everybody right now on the Republican side is being very hawkish. I should also point out, though, on the Democratic side, the Iowa Quinnipiac poll that came out today showed that Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, is best to handle foreign policy. So I think the turn in the Democratic race towards foreign policy is just yet another sign of Clinton's strength in that race.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538. We're talking the latest in national politics. And the campaign of Jeb Bush has been one that's been in need of a little fresh energy, upward momentum from people who are looking for that from him. Is this what he needs? Is this the place for him to plant the flag and give some forward momentum?
Sure. I mean, this is one of the issues, foreign policy, where even the quote-unquote more moderate candidates like John Kasich, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, even when it comes to foreign policy, they tend to be just as hawkish as everybody else. It's a way to sort of bump up their conservative credentials, you might say. And so we see that Jeb Bush is arguing for a very forceful response. He wants the military involved in Syria, even more so than we are now. Right now, however, we don't see any polling that indicates that Bush is moving up in the polls. His favorable numbers are still as low as they've been throughout the entire campaign. And here's the other thing that should be spoken about. Yes, people like us, we're going to be talking about these events and talking about how they're affecting politics. But the polling indicates that even though people are concerned with terrorism, they're not necessarily listening to what the candidates are saying. They are more involved with planning their Thanksgiving dinner than they are listening to what Jeb Bush has to say. So even though Bush is putting these things out right now, we may not see the actual effect of those for at least a month or two until we get really, really close to Iowa.
Well, it's a long ways out till actual, voting day in November. If there are no new attacks, no new credible threats, things that come to the fore in the news in terms of strikes, terrorist strikes, is it possible that the awareness to ISIS could decline by then and that the economy could be the number one issue by the time we get to November?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look back during the 2007-2008 cycle, at this point, foreign policy topped the economy as the number one issue. And then when you jump forward to the general election, it was all about the economy. There is still a very, very long way to go until the actual voting takes place, at least in the general election. Obviously, the primaries are closer, but we're still 9 weeks from that. So a lot of things can change. So what is true right now in the race doesn't necessarily have to hold true in 9 weeks, let alone in a year when people are voting whether they want a Democratic or Republican to be their president.
And you mentioned Hillary Clinton as being seen as somewhat hawkish among Democrats. How does she stack up to, say, some of the top contenders on the Republican field?
I mean, the Republicans are pretty much always going to be more hawkish than the Democrats are. I mean, perhaps, Rand Paul might be an exception to that. But Clinton, more than just being more hawkish than, say, Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley, she also has foreign policy credentials. She served as the Secretary of State. She's somebody that's generally seen, if you look at the polling, who would be a better leader. She is the one who comes out on top of that on the Democratic side, versus a lot of these Republicans who are sort of, at the forefront now. If you look at Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, you're dealing with candidates who either A, have no elected office experience at all, or B, have very, very little. Ted Cruz was just elected in 2012, and Marco Rubio was just elected in 2010. So that could be a very interesting dynamic as we head into the general election, because usually foreign policy is a strength of the Republicans. But if people are looking for someone who has experience, it may in fact play into Clinton's hands.
If we look at President Obama, and we started off the hour with his briefing from earlier today, how is he standing up to all this? I mean, ISIS has been around during his tenure. They're still here. They're still causing havoc and violence and bloodshed in the world. Is that going to cast a poor light on Democrats?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing. If you look at the polling, you see that Obama's approval on terrorism is dropping to its all-time lowest levels. And if you look at his overall approval rating, it does seem, although, it's very difficult to try and pick these stuff out, it does seem that it has dropped a little bit. And in this day and age where people are really voting along party lines instead of for individual candidates more so than ever, that could be potentially very harmful to Hillary Clinton. Although, again, we're still 12 months away from the general election, so we shouldn't say anything with too much certainty yet.
Now, there's been some news stories about that the tone of what's going on the ground at Donald Trump's appearances at his rallies, that there has been some altercations between protesters and supporters. What's going on there?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, the one instance, you know, I think there was an African-American gentleman who was an activist, and they basically, there was some very, very hands-on stuff where they were probably touched the guy too much in trying to get him out of the room, and then Trump made what I would call a typical Trump comment, saying, we're not going to deal with the protesters, he shouldn't be here, you know, get rid of him, and this is a type of thing that if you look at the polling, you know, this is a country that's becoming more and more diverse. And Republicans, if they're going to win, they're going to need to do one of two things. One, they're either going to need to win an even larger percentage of the white vote, or two, which is what most Republican operatives want to do, is win some minority voters. And if you just look at Trump's numbers among African Americans and Hispanics, they are lower than they are among any of the other GOP candidates. This type of rhetoric that Trump is issuing may be very nice to his supporters, and there's a reason why he's led this GOP race, granted with a limited sort of number, only in the mid-20s. But among the general elected at large and minorities who generally don't tend to vote Republican, his numbers are far worse than any of the other candidates, which could be very, very bad news going into the general election.
Right, and so could he get the nomination with numbers like that?
I mean, he's not going to win the nomination if he continues to lead the Republican field with numbers, you know, the national primary polls have him between 25 and 30%. What he needs to do is expand upon his base in order to win once this field gets, you know, instead of 13 or 14 candidates, you get down to 2, 3, 4, or 5 candidates. He is going to need to convince other Republicans that he can win in the general election. Remember, you go back to 2012. The number one reason that Romney won that nomination was because people thought he was the best to take on Barack Obama in the fall election. And comments that Trump is making right now, in my mind, as people really begin to tune in the presidential race, are going to make a lot of Republican voters very antsy about believing that he is the one that can best take on Hillary Clinton.
And we leave it there. Great to talk to you, Harry.
Thanks for having me again.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time to talk about the latest in national politics.
Women and children who are victims of domestic violence often receive resources to help them heal, but can something be done to work with abusive men to avoid violence in the future?
That's where the ALMA Center comes in. They treat abusive men as trauma victims and try to end the cycle of domestic violence. A few weeks ago, the ALMA Center held an open house to celebrate a national award they received, the Celebrating Solutions Award. The ALMA Center won this award because of their innovative work towards healing abusive men and breaking the intergenerational cycles of violence.
Terry Strodoff is with us now to talk about the ALMA Center's work and why it's important to treat abusive men. She's the founder and president of the ALMA Center based in Milwaukee. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, take us to the beginning. Why was it important to have this focus on healing men who had committed acts of abuse?
I think I'm going to answer that in two ways. The first is a very practical way of thinking about it. As we think about domestic violence that happens in couples, we know from many decades of research that the vast majority of victims decide for really varied and complicated reasons to continue in the relationship, meaning that these relationships are ongoing. And we also know that people are raising children in the relationship. So when we think very practically about what needs to be done, it is we need to have a solution that is really focusing on the problem. So we need to work with men and perpetrators, abusers in the relationship to change the behavior, so that it doesn't pass on to the children. Very practical, right? Mm-hmm. The next question or the next place we would go to is, well, how do we do that? How do we actually work with men in this way? And that's where healing comes in. It goes to the root cause of the problem, helps us to understand where is this coming from in the first place. And what we know, what we've long known, right, is that the men that we work with at the ALMA Center, they're the little boys who have grown up in struggling families themselves. They've grown up witnessing domestic violence, experiencing violence and abuse in their home, dealing with a parent who's struggling with addiction. And we know from studies, abundant studies now, that this actually impacts the development of children in very profound ways, not because something is wrong with them, but because it's just affects the way that we develop emotionally, psychologically, socially, physically, affects all of these things. And we, growing up in that environment, adapt our behavior to survive what's happening in the family. And for what we also know is that men and women, girls and boys, they do that. Generally, they do that differently. With men and boys tend to respond in very outer directed ways that are about rage and about like putting it out upon other people, where girls and women tend to respond in very more internal ways about appeasing, about pleasing people. And so as boys are growing up in this environment, we know it is a root cause of what's happening. And think about what we do with boys and men in our society in general. We continue to socialize boys and men towards some very destructive ideas about masculinity that continue to attach being a man with being tough, being strong, controlling women, never showing emotion. And that adds on top of something that's already there about the trauma and turns into this a way of interacting in relationships that is really destructive, right? And what we have learned is that the only way out of that, actually, the only way out of that is to heal. So trauma is not who a person is, it's what happens to them. And in order to have them break that, we have to help people understand what happened to them and to figure their way out.
Talking to Terry Strodoff from the ALMA Center and their work on treating abusive men, helping them heal. So, Terry, as you just described it, a man is in this situation where they're committing acts of domestic violence or abuse, that's coming from a lifetime of learning from their own family, from society at large. So it's a tall order. How, on a practical level, do you help somebody at that point to change that behavior?
That's a really good question, because we have long heard as well that it's an intractable problem. It's always been here, that people can't change. And certainly it is very, very, very difficult to change. But when we think about what we're asking people to do, it's like changing their whole way of being in the world, right? And for some of us, changing something very discreet, you know, taking something out of our diet is something that is very difficult for us to change. And you think about changing everything you know about the world. But here's the thing that's very powerful about that, is that if everything that you know about the world is rooted in some very destructive ways of dealing with people, that's rooted in trauma, it's like it gets into your worldview and affects your worldview. And you begin to think, like, this is a dangerous world. It's an unprotected world. It's an unsafe world. I can't trust anybody in this world. I have to get people before they get me. I can't let down my walls and or my barriers. And so when you can begin to peel that back and help people to understand what happened to you to get to this understanding of the world, what happened that these ideas make sense for you, is then it actually becomes, people get to see it as a choice instead of just the way I am, just the way men are, just the way the world is. Like, oh, you mean I could actually choose, I could make decisions and choose to be different. And the ways that I have been, the behavior that I have been choosing, the ways that I have been acting, they haven't really been that great in my life. I'm not having great outcomes, you know? I'm not having wonderful, nurturing relationships. My kids might not even like me. I'm going in and out of jail, whatever the impact can be, that those things can be turned around to say, like, it's actually not what I want. It's actually not what I want in my life, and I could choose to have something very different. I could choose to be very different. And that's not an easy process. It's not a quick process. It's not quick for any of us to change anything in our life. So it's not something that, you know, that you learn it one day and then it's different the next day. It's a journey that people are on for many times their whole life.
What kind of results do you see from the men you've worked with?
Well, we have a very positive impact of working with men in terms of if we look just straight at repeat domestic violence offenses. We work with a lot of men in the criminal justice system, and our programming, completion of our programming, is able to reduce the repeat arrest rate by 86%. So that's a very exciting impact. What we see in terms of practical, real change is that men learn how to become fathers. Men learn how to become respectful partners, and that this is a problem that gets passed on from generation to generation to generation. The parents who are struggling with their own trauma, fathers who are struggling with their own trauma, cannot be a nurturing and engaged father for their children to help them learn to be something different. So when we can actually change, help men, support them in creating the change and them embracing the truth of who they are to be a loving, nurturing, respectful person, the ultimate thing that we see is that the next generation of children do not have to go through this. They don't have to grow up and heal the trauma that they've experienced. They can actually grow up with a sense of nurturing and a safe and protected world and be people who are not going to be bringing this to their children.
And Terry, I understand you just kicked off a project called The Men We Love. What is this?
It is actually going to be our 10th edition of The Men We Love, and it is a photojournal book that we produce, and it's a very beautiful book people keep around as a keepsake for their family, and it celebrates the many different ways that men are positive role models in our life, as fathers, as partners, as uncles and sons and teachers and mentors. And what happens is people take out a tribute page in the book for an important man in their life, and then the page includes original portrait photography. The people write a tribute story, and the book is released on the Friday night of Father's Day weekend. And you would be amazed at this, because there's actually a photograph taken, but many, many of the men who are in the book have no idea that they're going to be celebrated in this way. So it's also an incredible once-in-a-lifetime gift for people that that gets to stay as a family heirloom. And it's really beautiful, incredible, beautiful stories about all the different ways men matter. We do this because the men that we work with have a profound absence of positive male role models in their life. And we want to celebrate the ways that that matters in people's life, to point out that this is actually something that all of us have the ability to affect, all of us have the ability to interact with in the small things that we do. You know, many of the tribute stories in the book will talk about things like, oh, I loved my dad making pancakes for me on Sunday morning. The things that, when you're in a nurturing place, you can take for granted.
We'll leave it there. Terry, thank you so much for being with us. That was Terry Strodoff, founder and president of Alma Center. She was with us to talk about the work they do there with abusive men and the national award they just celebrated. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The Packers are officially tying a bow on the Brett Favre era when they retire his jersey on Thanksgiving Day.
Our next guest says Brett Favre is a metaphor for a lot of things. To borrow a line from NPR's The Giant Foam Finger podcast, Brett Favre, quote, spent the last few years of his 20-year career retiring, unretiring, switching teams, retiring again, unretiring again, and eventually playing for the Minnesota Vikings, one of the Packers' most hated rivals. End quote. So given the emotional roller coaster he put Packers fans in Wisconsin through, have we figured out exactly how to feel about Brett Favre yet? Here's Favre himself talking about his love for playing at Lambeau this summer when he was inducted into the Packers Hall of Fame in front of a huge Lambeau crowd.
Obviously, there's so many great games, so many great moments, and to share it with these fans, believe me, I have played elsewhere. There is nothing like this place. There's absolutely nothing like it.
NPR Stephen Thompson joins us to talk about his recent podcast for Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's called What We Talk About When We Talk About Brett Favre. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
So, Stephen, why is Brett Favre such a loaded topic for people who love football and even people who don't really care about football?
You know, it's funny. I did a piece for NPR called What We Talk About When We Talk About Brett Favre, and it's 13 minutes long, and just a conversation between two people, and I don't think we even scratched the surface. And I think when you start to look at it that way, when you break down the 20-year professional career and just all of the drama that swirled around him the entire time, you realize, like, he is just this vexing and eternal figure in American sports and certainly life, in Wisconsin, but even outside of it.
Was there something about the way he played, the kind of quarterback he was, that helped build up this myth, all this meaning to Brett Favre?
Well, I think myth is a really important word. I mean, he was such a naturally mythologicalable, that's a word.
It is now.
Kind of easy to mythologize athlete. You know, all that stuff like, oh, he's like a kid out there, like drawing up plays in the dirt and slinging out, throwing off his back foot. And that personality, that it made him such an almost like Paul Bunyan-esque figure in a strange way, where you would just be like, he was spitting up blood and then he threw five touchdowns, you know, while, you know, getting, you know, smashed by whatever defender. It made him such a natural mythological figure during his prime, and then during the course of his Then during the course of his decline as an athlete, he started to become a metaphor for all of these very human stories. Leaving the Packers and going to the Jets and then the Vikings felt very much like a metaphor for divorce. There are all these, and just any kind of failed relationship, if you're losing a job or just a metaphor for loss. Aging, there are all these metaphors for aging in Brett Favre. Can he still play? The idea of the athlete who stays too long, who stays past his prime, you know, is a big sports story. It's an eternal sports story, but it's also something that any of us, as we trudge through this waking life, are faced with. Do I qualified to keep this job forever? What am I going to do then? What purpose do I have as I get older and I age out of what I'm known for? And so. In a way, he's just this incredibly, while he is easy to mythologize, he is this incredibly human figure. And I think that comes out even more because of the way that he talks about it and the candor with which he would talk to reporters. He was somebody who was always thinking out loud. I mean, I think the first time Brett Favre started thinking out loud about retirement was like, literally 10 years before he actually retired.
Yeah, and at one point, don't you call him the youngest old man in football? I mean, he's thinking about this stuff when he's in his, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and he's already thinking about it and thinking out loud. He's walking you through the process. So was that why people kind of got fatigued by it, because he started so early?
I think the endless rounds of speculating about the retirement always made him feel at least 10 years older than he actually is. Like you said, you know, he was 28, 29 years old the first time. He was like, well, you know, maybe just a couple more years. You know, like there was suddenly this, like, he was just thinking about retirement. And I think our minds and the way we know about athletes when they're talking about the ends of their careers, you look at like Peyton Manning right now. Peyton Manning is at a point where he should be thinking about retirement. And he's like, what, 38, 39 years old. Brett Favre doing that 10 years ahead of time meant that you had that the clock just kind of got pushed 10 years up, where now you think of Brett Favre as this guy like in his 50s, even though he's, mid-40s?
This is a bizarre thing for the athletic profession, really, because, you know, you hear talk of this old player at age 33. Oh, they've been around 13 years. And the idea that you have this job, this life-enveloping job that's going to end before you turn 40, almost certainly, and then you've got another half a life to go. I mean, Brett Favre was not alone here.
No, absolutely, and this happens with athletes all the time. I mean, the average like career lifespan of most NFL players is just a few years. At which point, yeah, you certainly hope the person has an incredibly long and rich life to follow. I mean, I remember during the kind of the initial prime of Brett Favre and those wonderful Packer teams in the mid to late 90s, and they were talking about Reggie White on the screen and how, you know, he was coming up on the edge and how he was coming up on the end of his career. And they said, you know, in passing, like, you know, Reggie White is 36 years old. And this guy, I was watching at work and when I worked at The Onion, and this guy walked past my office and overheard that. And he said, Reggie White is 36 years old? I thought he was like my dad's age. You know? And I think there is this interesting process for really every professional athlete where they walk away from their sport and suddenly they're young again. They may not feel young, you know, physically. They've been getting the tar kicked out of them for in Brett Favre's case, 25 years, going back through college and, I mean, even further into high school. But, like, still, you know, I'm 43 years old and I don't consider myself, I mean, maybe on my worst day I do, I don't consider myself a particularly old man. And I'm older than virtually every player in the NFL.
We're talking about Brett Favre on the eve of his jersey retirement, talking with Stephen Thompson from NPR Music and Pop Culture Happy Hour. And Stephen, you likened the whole Brett Favre thing to a messy divorce.
Yeah.
And I guess in Wisconsin, it kind of felt like that. I mean, did you love Aaron Rodgers? Could you still love Brett Favre? Could you go back and forth on weekends? I don't know. But it was complex over here in Wisconsin. I don't know how the rest of the country read this. But what do you think about that divorce analogy? Why is that so apt?
part of what makes the divorce analogy seem so apt was that, like, it's like your spouse leaving you for your worst enemy. and having to come to terms not only with losing that central relationship in your life, but seeing that person go off and take up with the Minnesota Vikings. It just, it had this element of not only the sadness and the loss. And I mean, remember, you know, Brett Favre played some absurd, was it 297 consecutive games? Like, he never missed a game for the Packers for basically like the entire lifespan of people's football watching existence. You know, there are a lot of people who started watching football in, you know, 1993, 94, who just had never seen anyone else start at quarterback for the Packers. And then all of a sudden to have that person go to another team, it was very wrenching. And obviously it's all sports. You know, you don't want to necessarily put too much weight on it, but it hurt. I will admit, like, I was, of course, transposing my Packer fandom over my actual life at the time and taking it, you know, sort of extra seriously. But it has actually taken a few years to kind of move beyond it and like realize, A, life goes on. B, you know, it's football. And C, like, look, Aaron Rodgers, you know, life goes on. Happiness is not a zero sum game. You know, both parties in a divorce can move on, find other people and be happy.
So this has been a learning experience for you, a growth experience.
It has. Really, this is the only way that I have ever grown personally. It's through lessons that I've learned as a Green Bay Packers fan.
Well, and Packer fandom and the organization is maybe learning that lesson too. As we mentioned, that jersey retirement, his number is one of just a handful of Packers numbers going to be hanging up there at Lambeau. It's going to be retired. Nobody else will wear it. So people are putting the ugly divorce behind them in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, eventually cooler heads prevail. You know, Brett Favre, as frustrated as I was with him late in his career, from the retirements to the leaving to the, you know, going to the Vikings and all that, like, Brett Favre was a wonderful player to watch and a wonderful member of the Green Bay Packers. And so many of my favorite sports memories are inextricably tied to this wonderful player, and sometimes vexing and maddening and infuriating player. And I, you know, I love to see people, like, now that a few years have passed, certainly all's well that ends well. Aaron Rodgers has, you know, won a Super Bowl and is a wonderful player. It is so time. Like, it is so, forgiveness is so important in divorce as in sports. So I'm thrilled to see him kind of returning to the Packer family and being embraced as the legend that he is.
We'll leave it there. Stephen, thanks. Good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you guys too. Thank you.
Stephen Thompson is a writer and editor for NPR Music. His special sports-themed edition of Pop Culture Happy Hour is called The Giant Foam Finger, what we talk about when we talk about Brett Favre.
And we want to hear from you now. What do you talk about when you talk about Brett Favre? We know it's the Aaron Rodgers era and Packers fans have moved on, as they should have, but is Brett Favre a hero to you, or did he fall from grace? Do you forgive him for the waffling, for playing for the Vikings? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. As the Packers get set to retire the story jersey of Brett Favre tomorrow, we're asking you to answer the complex emotional question, how do you feel about Brett Favre these days?
There's all the retiring, the unretiring, speculation about retiring, and ultimately, playing for the Minnesota Vikings. Are you over it all, ready to honor what he did, or is there always going to be some scarring there from the past? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. Mary is first in Racine. Hey, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I would just like to say I never really was ever really bitter with Brett Favre. I was more emotional about how he was treated towards the end and the horrible things that were said about him in the paper and commentary and, you know, over the water cooler at work. Because what he brought to football and what he brought to Green Bay, he turned it all on again. I remember what Green Bay and the Packers were like before he went in for Mikowski. I remember it clearly. I don't think a lot of people remember how hard it was to go and watch a game. It was, you know, years and years of the Packers just not getting there. And he brought so much back. Did he make some good decisions? Was it bad at the end? Absolutely. But I think for me, the way he was treated by the fans hurt more. And it's just kind of embarrassing because we are such a great fan state, you know.
Right. You think maybe so, there should have been more loyalty shown at the end.
I think so. I mean, let him, you know, let him play for the Vikings. He didn't play well. And so we all kind of got the last ha-ha, you know. You thought you could go and beat us and you didn't. But I think overall, because of what he's brought to the game as a quarterback, and now you see other quarterbacks trying to imitate or duplicate what his risk-taking was, the chances he took, and, you know, just overall playing with passion and just true love of the sport.
All right. Mary, thank you so much. A lot of passion there from you, too. Mary is way over anything that Brett Favre might have done.
I don't think she was ever not over it, in a way. Yeah. We'll go back to the callers now. David is on the line in Portage. David, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Yeah, I kind of mirror what the previous caller just said. I am a little embarrassed by how some fans in Wisconsin treated him when he left. But my overall thoughts were he brought so much joy. Again, as the previous caller said, the years of Mikowski and before were painful to watch. And not too long after he joined the team, and of course we got to mention Reggie White as well. He really, really brought football back to Wisconsin for many, many years. Took us to two Super Bowls, won one. What he did after that, I think, is just the love for the game. I don't, you know, whether the flip-flopping where they retire and didn't retire, I think is kind of nonsense because he's allowed to do that. He was torn whether to retire and spend time with his family or play the game he just loves since a young boy. And I will say, again, with the Minnesota Vikings, he actually did pretty well with the Minnesota Vikings. He was one play away in New Orleans from taking that team to the Super Bowl at his age. I think, you know, I tip my hat to Brett Favre. I have the utmost respect for him and will always admire him and wish he was still playing, actually.
David, thank you so much for sharing that. We are talking about Brett Favre, what he meant to the game of football, to the Packers, to fans in Wisconsin, to you. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go now to Jack joining us in Baraboo. Jack, hi.
Yeah, you know, listening to the callers, it brings back so many memories. Let's start at the very end when he played for the Vikings. The New Orleans game, that was the game where he was really roughed up, and the players were taking a lot of late hits at him, and he didn't get the calls, and he should have. Okay, over time people have said that. I mean, that was a game where the coaches were accused of paying, you know, anybody to hurt him, you know. And then you go to the beginning when Mike McCarthy and Ted Thompson came in, it was like, you know, here's, you know, Brett, King of Green Bay, and now these two guys come in and they want to dethrone him. I don't know if it's an attitude thing or whatever, but it just didn't work out. And, you know, so he went to another team. Hey, you don't want me on my team. I'm going to go make money someplace else. And, you know, he went to the Jets and did okay. And, you know, everybody's got to remember that it takes a long time for a quarterback to get into a system. And when you play for a team, you know, one season, you know, one preseason or one summer camp and preseason, then you play the regular season, and you just don't have the timing and everything.
Right,
with Minnesota,
right.
He did a little better. He had a little better quality players. But, again, you know, it was, you know, in New Orleans, it was one throw from getting it, you know.
Right, yeah, we've heard that in one throw away. It's not as though his career ended at Green Bay.
Right.
He had some play left in him.
Definitely. We heard from Greg on Facebook, though, who says Brett Favre's unretirement is a cautionary tale, he says, for professional athletes. Retire, go fishing, simple, don't mess it all up by making a comeback, however tempting. Thanks for that, Greg. That's a lot of debate on that, but as we've been talking, I kind of feel sympathy thinking back. I mean, everybody has a big life decision to make at some point. You might go back and forth on it for weeks or years, even. This happened to be somebody doing that in like at the center of the most popular sporting event in the nation.
And someone also far younger than anyone in almost any other career would have to consider. It would be like me saying, Rob, you better hang it up. You're pushing whatever it is.
Well, I hope not. But wait, are you telling me something?
Am I? No, not really.
I'll go over to the Vikings, too, then. No, I don't think they want me. We'll go back to our callers, though. We've got Mark on the line in Waukesha. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, I just, to be honest, got really, really sick of the back and forth, whether or not he's going to show up to training camp and stringing everything along. And that does a lot of damage to the team because they don't know if this focal point of the team is ever going to show. And to be honest, I think he really marred his image long-term with a lot of people in the state. And I just, I welcome Aaron Rodgers, really do.
So you're not, we talked about people still feeling some of that that maybe bitterness about Favre. You're not over that.
No, you got to be a man and stand up for something. And he was back and forth, teeter-tottering all the time, and that just gets really old.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts. Talking about Brett Favre, what we thought about him then, think about him now as his jersey is getting retired tomorrow at Lambeau.
That's right. We're going to go back to our callers now to pick up a call here from Karen in Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what is your take?
I am a huge supporter of Brett Favre. I think that there was a lot going on behind the scenes that a lot of us didn't see involving Mike McCarthy and their plan to have Aaron Rodgers play after sitting on the bench for 3 years. And they saw something in Aaron Rodgers that they liked, and I think it was more of the decision of the administration of the Packers to end Brett Favre's career with the Packers.
Do you think it was more the administration there, but did he toy with your heart at all, Karen, with the back and the forth and the retiring and not retiring?
No, I think that was his decision to make, but I think he definitely still wanted to play, and I think he definitely wanted to continue playing with the Packers.
Great. Karen, thank you so much for your thoughts.
I'll go next to Brent in Madison. Brent, hi.
Yeah, hi there. How are you guys? Thanks for taking my call. Great program. I just wanted to say I pretty much agree with the other callers. I think Brett Favre, it'd be hard to say that he wasn't one of the best things to ever happen with the Packers. And, you know, you got to remember how he came in. He came in when Mikowski got injured in a game, and from there on out, him and Mike Holmgren kind of turned things around completely. I mean,
Brent, thanks a lot. We have run the clock down here in the fourth quarter. Thanks for all of your calls. You can keep sharing your thoughts, though, over on the Central Time Facebook page.
The universe got a little stranger 100 years ago today when Albert Einstein presented his theory of general relativity.
I don't claim to fully understand how this works. Definitely not the calculus equations behind it. But here's what I take away. A lot of what we humans, scientists and not, had taken for granted about the universe turned out not to be true. Time, space, matter. Einstein's math shows that they interact in ways that were and are mind-blowing.
So just for example, space curves around objects with a lot of mass. Things like, say, stars. Oh, and that's what makes gravity happen, just as an aside. And it makes time run at a different speed. It makes light bend. And it's complicated stuff to wrap a human mind around.
I like trying to wrap my mind around it. I don't completely, I would say. And I like science fiction books. You know, I'm a science fiction fan. I like ones that play by Einstein's rules and figure out, okay, you can't space jump from here to another galaxy. There are rules. You age differently as you travel through space, so it's really weird to contemplate how all that would work.
And again, notice we did not try to describe in detail why this is true by a mathematical proof. David,
oh no, I'm going to do it now.
Oh great. Well,
no,
how about,
okay,
what do you think we let David Tennant do it instead?
Sure, yeah. We put a link on the Central Time Facebook page to an animated explanation of general relativity narrated by the Time Lord David Tennant of Doctor Who fame.